Hey, we'll be starting in just a minute.
Thank you.
Conference muted.
I think our committee knows that today is the day, though. After this point, we're really going to have to
to do some work and actually start to make some changes in the protocol. We didn't feel like we should do that until we had an opportunity for most of the states to weigh in before we try to really put anything on paper. So the proposed changes so far, Delta Airway defined the contraindications to nasal tracheal intubation or have it added to the nasal tracheal intubation procedure protocol. For failed airway, reference trauma patients with regard to head position, abdominal pain, and stop me if you have questions. I'm just going to kind of breeze through these things just to let you know what's there. For abdominal pain, remove need for orthostatic blood pressure protocol. I think most of us agree that the evidence for orthostatic blood pressure is scanty at best and probably doesn't contribute to the overall picture pre-hospital, even if in the hospital as well. Nausea and vomiting, if available, consider to specific medication for med protocol. And that's a pretty common theme throughout the protocols where would be the one endable thing in individual protocols where that particular service could put the antiemetic or benzodiazepine that they carry in the protocol. Reference to pain control, change to specific medications as per the local control. And referrals, change ectopic pregnancy to pregnancy-related and remove specific reference to appendicitis, two numerous possibilities and covered in the differentials, and there was a request that they should be listed alphabetical. For altered mental status, note for spinal immobilization if suspected trauma, and then reference to Narcan, remove the reference to if respiration is depressed, remove, consider oral glucose, and consider other causes included in the differential.
Do we stop right here? Sure.
Yeah.
What's the remove reference to if respiration is depressed?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most of us agree that that it should be used only if we think somebody's in respiratory failure, depressed to the point that they're going to die from that, and not wake these folks up in the back of an ambulance to harm a crew. So I agree with you 100%.
So, but what we're doing is removing that, which will allow Narcan to be given more broadly.
Right. And not, that is actually one of the things that was mentioned in the survey. So not necessarily from the committee. That actually is from the survey.
Okay.
But I would agree with you. I don't think we should wake everybody up with a narcotic overdose.
I would prefer actually that we
don't. Right, moving into ED.
For a drowning protocol, if the patient is in cardiac arrest, follow the appropriate cardiac arrest guidelines. Initiate advanced airway management if the airway cannot be managed properly utilizing basic life support airway maintenance. ALS providers should utilize advanced airway management with endotracheal intubation attached an entitled CO2 device, maintain level between 35 and 45. I guess the other thing we probably should consider is the AHA changed the nomenclature of this to drowning submersion incident or submersion accident. So we possibly could entertain changing the protocol name to come in line with the AHA recommendation. For respiratory distress, add CPAP and magnesium in wheezing section. Any comments from the directors about magnesium? From my personal perspective, it seems like the study showed that that's only really of utility in the pediatric population in the very severe asthmatics. So I don't know the utility in adults. I'd agree CPAP should be added, yes. For drug-assisted intubation, still more medical oversight should be employed on the local end, and in turn, the protocol relaxed to include appropriate paralytic instead of just succinylcholine. That way, roxuronium or other paralytic may be given initially if succinylcholine is contraindicated or unavailable, as we have found out. Childbirth, add section for hypertension or abnormal vaginal bleeding, which would direct you to the obstetrical emergency protocol. Change rapid transport to expedite transport with early notification. For newborn, eliminate the word thick from meconium and only recommend deep suctioning if the patient is non-vigorous. Limit intubation to one attempt. For spinal immobilization clearance, the protocol implies spinal clearance. There's a thought that we should look at this as to when to immobilize, not the negative, when not to immobilize. And there was some feeling that the protocol may have been approached from the wrong direction from that regard. and a proposed change to title spinal immobilization instead of spinal immobilization clearance. For pain control in the adult, this should be left up to the medic to make the determination, not a predetermined scale. All a medic will do anyway is decide if the pain is 1 or a 10 if they want to give pain meds. Nitrous oxide and acetaminophen ibuprofen can be placed with other med options instead of a section with pain less than 6. Vital signs should be checked every 5 to 10 minutes for drug reactions. Contraindications to meds should be in the drug list with each med, not in the pearls. Comment or the warning of ibuprofen and Toradol should be in the contraindication on the drug list. Pain severity, pain control in the pediatrics, again, should be left up to the medic to make the determination about a predetermined scale. Nitrous oxide, acetaminophen, ibuprofen as well can be placed under under a comprehensive section, not just under a pain scale 6 or less. And it looks like the same. I think one issue is the dosing in the protocol. For acetaminophen, it's listed as 10 mg per kg, and actually it's 15 mg per kg, so that didn't show up. Hypertension, comment about nitroglycerin use is listed in the signs and symptoms and do not need to be placed in the pearls. Fever, remove the age requirement for acetaminophen. Remove the infection control part, because this is all covered under OSHA, and remove all pearls but the last 5. For PEA, remove atropine. Questionable epinephrine drip. Is anyone doing epinephrine drips in the state?
Yes.
Keep only the last pearl. For SVT, change wording to consider adenosine, diltiazem, beta blocker. This way the medic could decide which to treat for underlying AFib versus sinus tachycardia. Seizure, remove the repeat times 1 in 5 minutes. This will be covered in the drug list per county. Remove most of the pearls. We should not have to define the different types of seizures. For weapons of mass destruction, the nerve agent protocol suggests in the top box, signs and symptoms incorporate universal sludge them into box. Most have been included, but actually list that acronym out. For respiration, difficult breathing, distress, short of breath, wheezing, make a comprehensive protocol. Agitation with central nervous system signs, confusion, agitation, seizures, coma, and incorporate a table for treatment into a central box, such as severe respiratory distress, agitation, monitor every 3 minutes and the use of the auto-injectors. Any questions about? For police custody, change fourth bulleted line to read the responsibility for patient health management rests with the highest medical authority on the scene. Change third bulleted line to read the law enforcement officer shall accompany the patient in the ambulance if the handcuffs are to remain applied. However, if EMS personnel restrain the patient according to the procedure outlined in the policy, the law enforcement officer may elect to follow the ambulance in a patrol car to the receiving facility. Change sixth bulleted line to read, regardless of the arrest status, the competent patient never loses the right to participate in the decision-making process regarding his or her medical care. Universal patient care protocol, add the EMS, the bear, to the protocol, and the bear symbolizes when pediatric care is warranted and medical control is required. Do not utilize pulse oximetry as the sole means for determining heart rate. For the IV protocol, suggested that we abandon it because it's listed in other protocols. Syncope, no changes. Post-resuscitation, no changes. Hypo and hyperthermia, no changes. And I actually put this together yesterday with Brian Berry, our EMS PI, just to kind of incorporate some of the changes that were most common across the state. So in looking at the rapid sequence intubation, it didn't really change very much. Added under ensure adequate IV suction equipment to prepare alternative airway device. We added the doses of lidocaine, added the doses of etomidate, and in the paralytic we added succinyl, choline, or rocuronium in their respective dosages. Beyond that, not really much changed. This actually showed up. Sorry, this was not showing up on my computer, but this is the box that we consider to make it editable for each individual service. where you can place in that box to consider your benzodiazepine of choice for sedation, Versed versus Valium. Any questions about that?
If you're on the phone, press 5-star if you have a question. Since we know that drug shortages are just particular, we thoughts about accommodate to be able to, you know, do benzodiazepines and other stuff on the front side.
Yes, there has been some discussion in the committee, but we haven't come to a conclusion, but there has been discussion.
Or at least allow a local control to change.
Right. One other thing that was mentioned throughout the survey is the idea about algorithmic versus paragraphical protocol. I'm actually kind of a fan of the algorithmic, but so this is something that is proposed is the protocol would look just like this. The left-hand page is the protocol. The right-hand page would be what we're calling the medical director's page, where that director could put their own pearls, instructions on how to interpret the protocol, could add their own thoughts concerning the protocol, but not change the standardized protocol. It would just be a supplement to endorse, but not to change our standard. Thoughts about that?
How do you change it? Your local practice doesn't follow the current established flow chart.
I think if you were going to, I would have to defer back to the rules as they're written and how we would change protocols under the current OMS rules. That page would be only to put your own pearls in as a medical director, not to actually change the care that's dictated in a protocol without going through the appropriate channels.
Well, right now those channels are this group.
Right.
So starting out, we've already heard through the survey, local communities want to design their own practice, their own flowchart, text or graphical. By design, by accepting this, we're back at the table of setting state flowcharts. And only pearls under your explanation.
Right. Well, I may have to defer to Dr. Mears on that because under our current OMS rules, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the rules are that there is a set of state protocols. So that's the challenge that NSF has to provide, is a set of state protocols. And to change those, you have to meet that criteria that you're adding a treatment or whatever.
Right.
So we've still got to stay with the concept of a single set of protocols.
Yes, sir.
I think this would be extremely helpful because frequently medics will come to me and I'll say, what does this mean? I'll say, here's laughing. It means, can you put that in writing somewhere? So we've got emails and documents.
Right.
I think the nice thing about this would be that the algorithms are streamlined enough that they're subject to interpretation. And they come to me wanting the interpretation, so there can either be a cultural kind of understanding where you can have them.
Right.
So I think that's a very nice middle ground.
And that's the same experience I have. Medics asked me for an interpretation of the protocol. So I thought about putting some pearls up there today, but I did not want to put anything down because I didn't want you to think that's what this protocol was going to look like. But I can tell you from my perspective, what I would likely list on this particular protocol is I would probably list the 7 P's that we go by for rapid sequence intubation and give an explanation through each of those 7 P's about what I would expect when you carry out this protocol. And for looking, most folks, I don't know how everybody does their protocols. From us, we put them in a notebook. So looking at the size of the protocols, we certainly didn't want to make them like encyclopedias. So this really would not add volume to the protocol because the left page, they'd be front and back. Left page would be protocol. Right page would be the director's page that complies with that protocol.
Other comments? On the phone, 5-star, we'll open it up. I've got a question. If you go back, you mentioned patients under custody and the phrase, the competent patient never loses the right to participate. Competency or capacity?
It should be capacity.
Yeah.
Competency is a legal term.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, good point.
This bothered me, though, with the police custody. You're saying that if the officer feels that he can uncuff him and put him back in your truck, then you restrain him by medical control, and he follows you. I mean, that's basically what I was saying.
Yeah, I this was for, again, this was surveys from across the state, and I can tell you that in my
own. With me being a very active field medic,
I would agree. I can tell you in my own county, we've had this issue that's come up a great deal. We've actually had to sit down with our law enforcement agents, and we've had to actually draw out a policy that we've all signed that we're going to agree to when it comes to just
our guys are not kind of real active. They're really understanding with us, but, you know, that's just dangerous.
I think there's a difference here between a person who's in police custody and a person who had a mental health breakdown that the police security team got them come,
right.
And now they're ready to go. That's a separate
right.
Interfer, I agree with
that. It is. Right.
I think that's
a good point, and that's actually most of the problems that we have is with that mental health patient.
If there's an extra protocol, the person already in custody along.
Right, I agree with you. There should not be wiggle room to allow the officer to take them out of.
If they're responsive, they're RFI, they can put them on a cross officer.
Right.
Maybe
have another helmet. I mean, the key word is arrest.
Right.
I don't see that on here either. The fact that law enforcement may have cuffed someone doesn't necessarily mean they're restrained and not.
Right, they may be
detained. So I think if they're under arrest and the management of that patient is now a cooperative venture between law enforcement and EMS, but with law enforcement present for chain of, for custody, say.
Well, the issue we deal with, too, is we have two prisons in our county. One is a maximum security, one is a minimum security. We're constantly transporting prisoners who are in custody that are shackled and handcuffed, and you know, so that's normal for us to have that. And unless they're completely unresponsive and we absolutely need them, they'll not uncuff them. I would absolutely have to do it for a procedure.
But are they accompanying?
They're accompanying.
They're accompanying the patient.
Greg, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but do you have any? Greg is the assistant EMS director for Stokes, so he and I have shared the common ground with this very issue. So I don't know if you had any comments about this, and just maybe share some of the experiences
our
we've had.
Mainly with the mental health one, where they were not under arrest, but they needed to be put into police custody or emergency protective custody. We've drawn up a policy to our county attorney right now. We're still waiting on it, but it was a joint effort, and we'll be glad to share it with anybody if they would like to view it. It defines law enforcement responsibility, our responsibility. That way there's no get in the ambulance if you don't want to go to jail, or go with the police because if you don't want a $400 bill, you know, it gets rid of those things.
Right. Yeah, it certainly allows some wiggle room to put the crews at risk, I think.
Okay, right.
Let's see.
I've got a committee at large, and I've got two other comments. One, has there been any thought to splitting the overdose toxic ingestion protocol into two separate protocols, one focused on overdose pharmaceuticals and free drugs, the other one does on looking more at the toxicological issues?
Yes, actually, that particular protocol is mine within the committee to work on it, and I would agree with you that the protocol definitely needs to be beefed up a bit and maybe changed. I plan on actually working with some toxicologists when we look at that protocol.
The other thing is we toss this around inside of our own service of taking the nomenclature of a drug-assisted innovation and make it more of a drug-assisted airway management protocol. I know I'm probably getting a horse, but looking at giving the medic the option of using an advanced airway, the team, particularly for us, versus innovation as a first pass, not making that a failed airway instead of a drug-assisted airway management.
So, if I understand you correctly, you would do a rapid sequence blind insertion airway device.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And that may make that person a little more enticing to services who don't have a ability to maintain innovation training standards.
Or too enticing.
Right.
Yeah, but what's the evidence on that?
The evidence of success with the King Airways, been there. And I'm figuring one of the kings is what we use.
Well, I guess the argument would be if a patient is at the state that they can tolerate a blind insertion airway device, if a patient is at the point that they can tolerate a blind insertion airway device, it sounds like rapid sequence augmentation of that would kind of be moot. I mean, if they're able to tolerate a blind insertion airway device at all, they're probably to the point where you would not need to sedate or paralyze.
Well, I'm talking about the people that have booster head trauma, CBA, splinch knee, that trismus effect, if you can break that. If those patients that need to be intubated or have an advanced airway plate to still maintain their gag, be able to use pharmacological interventions to put them down to facilitate placement of the
team. I don't know of any literature to support it at all.
Why would you just not bag that patient?
Good.
Risk is less. Efficacy is probably higher. I mean, what I'm hearing is medication for a blind insertion airway device doesn't even meet the gold standard for full intubation. And if they have something physiologically in their airway that needs to be managed, you're not going deeper than the glottis.
Doctor here said it's a matter of you're protecting the airway.
Well, the blind insertion airway device doesn't protect the airway. And if you think it's going to be hard enough to intubate where you need, if you're paralytic and you think it's going to be hard enough intubation, you can't use direct laryngoscopy, then you shouldn't be paralyzed because the blind insertion airway devices don't always work either. If you think if you're already taking away one of your modalities, you're going to have trouble with DL, then I sure as heck don't want you paralyzed and just hope it's going to get the BIAD. And if you don't do direct laryngoscopy enough to feel comfortable with it, then you shouldn't be doing paralyzing and taking away their ability to breathe anyway.
Something we can certainly try to pull some literature on. I've never read any or seen any. All right, the burn protocols actually have been submitted from UNC, and these are the only protocols so far to date that we have in writing, and thanks to all those folks at UNC, there's not a lot of changes on the burn protocol. It looks a little different because the rule of nine was removed from this protocol to make it a little easier to see. But I went online and compared these to the existing protocols. I didn't really see a lot of change. It looks a little different, but I didn't see a lot of substantive changes to the protocol itself. And that as well for the chemical and electrical burn. This would be a new addition, the radiation protocol. It's probably a little bit hard to see, but just incorporate some of the time distance shielding and symptom severity. So that would be a new addition, as well as the blast protocol.
And all this will go up on the website if you have to review actually.
And pediatric thermal burn, not a great deal of change other than, again, the rule of nine diagram had been removed to make it a little easier to read. There are some new guidelines or decision trees for inter-facility transport protocol. So this would actually be a new addition rural burn injury would also be another new addition. They added a fluid formula.
Once again, the burn center has submitted 12 pages of protocol. Even, well, but the diagram still comes back. Right,
right? The diagram's back. It's just easier to read. And it takes its own page.
Last time around, we took some of this and put it in the appendix.
Right.
So where's the kit on this?
It's
still really, really
tiny.
No, but I took what I think that's what most people aren't familiar with. And so it's just interesting that it would just be nice that we can actually read it.
And perhaps dedicate a page to them.
Yes.
Well, you know, if you did a split page with the medical director comments, that would be a good page.
The digital document will save that.
Yeah.
Well, also that the medical director's page would be up to the individual service, but there may be protocols that you would not put a director page on if the director did not want to.
More.
Yeah, this triggers
open these emails.
A burn medical disaster. basically, when you have five or more burn patients, it would trigger a burn disaster, and there is a condition tree out.
Whoa! that is a protocol written by one physician with an agenda.
Yes.
And I do not believe the state office should be endorsing, or the North Carolina Council of Emergency Physicians should be endorsing a particular protocol, a particular kind of problem, a particular physician.
Sure. Okay.
That should be removed.
Yeah, they're up there for comments. So.
Now, there's a comment.
How about your opinion, Dr. Mark?
And we haven't finished.
Oh.
So, hospitals without a burn center, decision tree.
It's not really MS anymore.
Hospital trauma centers without a burn center.
What is the urban burn? You know,
we have triage templates for things like STEMI, and I mean,
right.
We just not fall into the same type of
is
triage.
Is front of a transfer?
Yeah.
Is there one under that?
There's one.
There's a destination.
The last time around, we got a whole lot of papers they sent us, and we included some of it.
Yeah,
well,
right.
When you are a hammer.
Isn't our burn as part of the triage and destination plan?
Yeah.
It's burn and trauma, and it's already there.
Right.
It's already there.
So these are individual.
In hospital policies to follow particular burn centers treatment algorithm.
Yeah, I agree. Especially the hospital protocols have no bearing for us. Hey, just a quick poll. Medical director's page. Just a vote. Who would like to see it? Who would not like to see it? First, who would like to see it? You think? Who would not like to see it? All right, so almost easy.
Can I add a third item to that?
Sure.
Of the medical directors here, given the option to accept a stock protocol other than by title, state protocol by title, would you prefer to create your own flowchart/text variety across all whatever gazillion protocol mandates there are? NSAID does you a favor by creating that for you. In effect, is what we're saying.
No comment.
Okay. Here's the question. And whether it's graphical or whether it's text-based, does that matter?
Yes.
You, who for graphical? Who for text-based? I know the Durham folks are represented. Okay. Because that was comments back again on the survey. All right. Just one. But that's burn zero. Graphics, lots of burn. A five.
Any questions so far?
All right,
you may have addressed the issue of placing medications on the protocol themselves. Is that something you envision with the medical directors page, quote unquote, or have you guys decided on how to tackle that? Because I know that's
a
sticking point amongst a lot of people.
I think most people on the committee, and I'm speaking for casual it's conversations we've had over emails and things like that, but I think most people are in agreement that they would like the medications and dosages in the protocol. And that's why I put up that airway protocol that I worked on yesterday, just to show what it might look like with the medication dosages there, and then a box where there are multiple medicines that you could choose from, that you would actually go in and put your own medicine and dosages as long as it was on the formulary and was an approved drug. So, yeah, and that, so that was one of the reasons I just quickly did that yesterday with Brian, to show what it may look like.
If you're doing, so you're saying put it actually in the flow chart?
Yes.
Does that mean we're going to send these out in editable format?
There would be boxes in potentially the individual protocols that would be editable. Yes.
Well, the documents either editable or it's not. I mean, they can theoretically change anything they want to.
I'm not a PDF geek, but Brian tells me there's a way that can be locked to where you open up a particular section to be editable and the rest be standard. And
I can triage destination plans.
Consideration for consistency among the protocols, say for instance, dopamine in one protocol requires medical order, post arrest, I believe paramedics may do it by protocol. Consistency from one protocol to the other to make sure they're either both above the line or below the line. That way the medics don't have to remember, call in for an order or can I do it?
Right. And I agree with you. That was a survey comment. It just didn't make the board, but certainly there were some comments about dopamine being beyond medical control versus above medical control. So, and making those things more consistent across protocols.
Just along
those,
just another thought on the whole medications on the protocols. It would be nice to have all the options. And I realize in space and vision. Limitation for a lot of us, besides the bookers, to have all the medications at each of the protocols. And I'm pretty sure the survey suggests there's a ton of overlap in folks working in multiple agencies. Even though I'm a multi-county agency, our folks still work in non-group health systems. And for them one day to be given one H2 blocker in one system and the next day having to remember what the other one was, I think it would just be a lot easier if they were all there. I don't know if you could, highlight the ones you want, or maybe you order them the way you want, or preference. I hate to have them. I guess I just like one standard protocol that has them all. Somehow figure out how to allow people some flexibility. I want fentanyl first
instead of morphine. I don't even want it. Our folks give them morphine. I want fentanyl in the water, but they're all there so everyone understands what they are and their choices.
Right.
Can I give you an opinion about this? The protocol is a teaching tool and it's a defendable process document. Your community may choose to have everything listed. My community doesn't want any error on where they're looking on the line. How do you assure at 2 o'clock in the morning when they're looking up a dosage, a medication dosage, that if your community is defined, as a medical director, you've defined what your practice is supposed to be in your backyard. And if you choose certain agents and dosages, that's what should be on the protocol. Does that mean there are 100 protocols set?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if each county has to have a system plan and EMS is relegated to the county line as the business unit, that may be the case.
I guess I would respond by saying just choose narcotics, for example, because I think that's an easy one to talk about. If you ask my folks doing a warning what first line narcotic IV administration is for extremity injury, they'll know that cold.
Right.
If 2 days later they're working across the county line for another medical director, and it's 2 a.m, they have the same circumstance, they may not know that cold, and therefore open up the book and look. Or that they may also know that, yes, Harmony prefers morphine, but we also know that in the state protocols, there's fentanyl and allotted, and those might be options in another system. Now, maybe that doesn't happen that much, but I thought our folks make more errors, and a large percentage of our medication errors are from folks that work in multiple systems. And granted, they're generally not severe errors, but we have protocol violations with medications.
But we've added to that by a document that makes you flip pages to find dosing. I mean, that's a patient safety issue.
I struggle with the whole concept, and I'm not pretending to have all the answers. I would definitely prefer to have the medication back in the protocol. Don't get me wrong.
And I know the survey support.
I'd like there not to be 100 different stuff in protocol books out there, which
I think
may not be realistic.
Yeah,
but
I think that's the reality of it.
But I think the standardization is still there. You know, just one box within that standardized protocol, and you just choose the agents that you've got. But I think that's what we run into is because there's agents on there that we don't carry, and folks coming across working in different places or wanting to get medicine that we may not carry or vice versa. So, but I understand because we have the same problem. So the next step, Donna Sutherland is going to talk about her some of her proposed changes to the pediatric protocol.
All right, don't shoot the messenger. The subcommittee has not seen this stuff yet, and this is an exchange. Obviously, this will be posted. Joe said that all of this will be posted. Understanding why anything, if people who know me and have worked with EMSC, there's a lot of things we have on a wish list. It doesn't mean that is, you know, something that you all have to capture. The other thing is we were asked for pediatric-based issues to truly write in all the dosages. So if I'm understanding at least one of the questions here, I went into every protocol that at all could have a pediatric dose and put in the pediatric dose for every drug. So that, and I tried to really put every max drug in, et cetera, et cetera. What I wanted to start with is something I hope is easy, so don't kill the messenger, and I give credit to David for this. We were asked a long time ago in the last revision about setting up some issues around special needs protocols. And right now, everything related to special needs is handwritten in the back of the protocols. This is where you'll find the care. So there are three protocols that will be posted for you all to review. This is something that came out of Dublin County, and David is really the one who really generated this. It came to EMSC. We made some changes to it and suggestions, and obviously now it has been brought to you all. There are three protocols that are there. There's this emergencies with children with central lines in, i.e. also porticaps. There is another one, if I'm getting a, there's another one on respiratory distress or special needs with trachs. And then the third one is the ventilator child. So these, again, are in a way in which you all are used to reading. So I think for the committee's sake and stuff, these will be posted. I'm not going to go through these line by line. We only have about 10 minutes. So really what I want to pitch to you all is some thoughts, because this document that got scanned in yesterday, which will be posted, is like 68 pages. So I don't know. It's going to be very difficult for me to start trying to scroll through this. I wanted to just bring up highlights for pediatrics, if that can work. The first thing in pediatrics is, like, all the EMS personnel are really taught about how to do assessments. So we thought we wanted to tag something about PAT. And somewhere in there, put an addendum, and just really talking about kids in the sense of how we define a child, that they're less than 50 kilos, and really using the PAT triangle for assessment. The other issue is there is, in the last revision, we really talked about only D10 and D50. And really, I've gone back and forth with this, and really what I suggest and something that you all need to have buy-in is that we should have three choices. We should have D10, D25, and D50 for adults. The children outside of D10, it's a lot of volume that you're giving D10 to, and that most kids it's easy, and it's a no-brainer just to take D50 and pick up half and add a half normal setting, you're done. It's a one-to-one. So outside the neonatal period, we're pushing more for D25 to be put into those protocols. The other issue, obviously, is obviously getting, really getting the AHA guidelines up to snuff, obviously just the CPR issue and how there's a little difference, especially with the neonates. And the biggest bang for the money is really looking at pediatric respiratory distress. What will be posted for you is right now the way it works is wheezing versus stridor. My hope is that we take this protocol that's out there, and we have a general protocol that basically starts with called pediatric respiratory distress, okay? When you get to the point of difficulty, you go to four different branches. That will bring in the stridor, which could be a foreign body versus a non-foreign body. So you'll have two branches. When you're suspicious for a foreign body, a set protocol to go to. If you're really just dealing with stridor, i.e. croup, you have a management issue in that sense as well. People ask for pediatric anaphylaxis or allergic reaction things, so to me, that went under respiratory distress. And again, there is a protocol written that is pediatric specific for you all to review. And then it branches to wheezing versus versus the issue of cardiac kids in the sense of really looking at those kids that really you're thinking are known cardiac kids and how to manage them differently than just the wheezing child. So that was our thought for you all to look at these. And I'm not going to belabor them, but really they go around. I've handwritten all of these, and I do apologize. I'm very old school. And so it tries to go through first responders, total versus partial obstruction, and it goes down that way in the sense of grades and what people would be doing. There is also the issue, i.e., for respiratory distress when we're looking at issues around, like, non-foreign body. So if they're mild versus moderate and how you would do it. So we're branching out just not all stridulous kids, but if it's just stridor, obviously, with a cough or something, cool mist, transfer, boom, be done, that kind of stuff. The stridulous patient in the sense of, you know, do no harm, something very simple, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you're going down for that impending respiratory failure, what you think. And I tried to simplify drug dosing and stuff. People with bronchiolitis talk about L-epi versus racemic epi, and we tried to keep it along the board of just epi in the sense of using L-epi for everyone and not having to worry about two different drugs because the literature shows that they're basically equal, okay? And if you're not in a place that standardizes and has it, how to mix it, taking your epi and mixing. So that would be part and something you can include so that your paramedics basically know how to take a little epi with some saline and deliver the medication in that respect. There's a lot of issue, and different agencies have already adopted this issue of less than 12 months, greater than 12 months when it comes to the wheezing child. So I've written up that protocol where it's more likely to be bronchiolitis versus, say, an asthma issue. Some people have asked to go right to L-epi or not in that sense. So you have a way to look at the protocol and go from there. I know that when I worked at Wake County, you know, Johnson County started with L-epi. Honestly, Brent, I don't know what Wake County has done for the younger kids. I think they flipped between that, just use albuterol. For the young kids. Okay, and then there's other counties that truly use L-epi. So it's fair to say, you know, if it's something that you all feel you're going to adopt universally, is it limited or not? And so this is where the protocols need to be looked. These are all evidence-based medicine, basically looked at. These are out of guidelines and benchmarks that are really been adopted by all pediatric tertiary care centers. Okay, and we're trying to take the disease process and management and see if basically it can be utilized or not utilized in the field, or you want to make it very simple, and for, i.e., bronchiolitis, albuterol doesn't work 9 out of 10 times. So, you know, do you want to adapt a med or not, or just keep it simple? And these are the things that basically you're going to see there'll be notes that I have on things, but you will see handwritten pages. That basically have, and it's scanned really far down here. The other thing for respiratory distress when you go and look through these things is this whole thing that people wish about the issue around respiratory distress, i.e. respiratory failure. we went back many years ago, I don't know how many years ago, we took, you know, intubation off the pediatric, you know, respiratory failure thing, and it was BBM, 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 BBM. And now, obviously, we have alternative airway issue. Understanding that the king is only for greater than 2 years of age. It was mentioned already about LMAs, and so there's an issue that I think in looking at that, that when you obviously have options for one or the other, and there will be equipment issues, that LMAs should only probably be stocked for kids less than 2 years of age when it comes to equipment, because you can't use a king for those kids less than that. Because if BBM is not working, if you have to go to alternative airway, we are still advocating that we are doing blind insertion airways, and we are not advocating for ET tube unless it's a last-ditch issue. And then the other question came up is there's been suggestions on the site about having a pediatric RSI protocol. Well, it's not scanned in here, but we, and I know this is going to be discussed with the subcommittee, but the overall gestalt which is out there is very difficult if you look at the scanning protocol thus far. Your scanning protocol thus far gives you the option for Atomidate. As you know, in the pediatric literature outside of head trauma, because a lot of these kids come in respiratory failure, infectious fever and stuff, we lean away from Atomidate. And in pediatrics, the literature is really ketamine, 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 or fentanyl. And ketamine is not on protocol at this point. Right, exactly. And so you're stuck in a situation where are we or are we not going to even go there? And I know this is something that the subcommittee will talk about and then post again, but I think you're very limited in pediatrics of where you are, what you do for drugs. And another thing that was just mentioned was the issue of succinylcholine. We do not use succinylcholine in pediatrics anymore at most pediatric emergency rooms and pediatric intensivists. There's too many downsides to it. There's too many kids that you don't know about their metabolic state. They're going to have an inborn error, et cetera, and that kid is going to die in your field. And so for those reasons, if you don't do enough pediatric airway, all of a sudden you're paralyzing that kid, using a long-acting paralytic, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's going to be up on the discussion board, and actually by July 13th, there may be some stuff that comes out of the subcommittee and obviously things that come out from you guys. So separate from that, you will see that obviously I've updated all the protocols like SVT, bradycardia, anything that needed subtle changes that it came to the new AHA guidelines. And then for all the, what I went through separate from all the pediatric protocols is any protocol that I felt could cross-react for anything related to peds, you will see drug dosing on all of them, et cetera, et cetera. I think a simple thing that we got missed in the first fever protocol is there is really levels of fever and degree of fever. I'm not trying to say we know that parents are fever phobic, but there are cold, there's who cares that they have a fever and I know you're giving Tylenol or Motrin, and then there's true hyperpyrexia. And we defined hyperpyrexia by 104, and it's really 106. So there's some of her terminology that needs to be changed when we're addressing fever in this algorithm that I suggest changes in treatment modalities, because that will then bring you to the hypothermia protocol. Does that make any sense? And again, what cold is defined as a temperature less than 96 degrees Fahrenheit in children or 35.5, which will bring them to the hypothermia protocol and management there. Brent, you look puzzled.
I just want to make sure we're still treating fever.
You are. No, I'm not saying, I didn't take it out. I didn't take it out. All I'm saying is you're allowed to treat fever, okay? It's a personal thing, like who cares, you know? It's the fever phobic. Yes, 100.4 to 105.9 is what I call fever. And then you go to hyperpyrexia or the hypothermia protocol. Does that make sense? And that's not clear on the fever protocol, all right? There are things that we're missing in different protocols, even for the 5-HS5Ps, and I found that. So those things are all kind of corrected in that respect. I could go on and on, but they're all there. Oh, this is going to be up for discussion. I know that the subcommittee already spoke about pain, that you yourself will subjectively decide if a patient needs pain medication or not, and not use any scoring system. And I know this may be opening up Pandora's box, We agree that the FACES score really has no applicability in the pre-hospital setting. The kids are scared to death of you. They're not going to tell you really their grade, so you're not going to get a number. The question is, you as a medical director, wherever you are, do you want to continue in the younger kids to do it subjectively and choose a drug, or do you want to take a much better objective scale called a FLAC scale? It's like an Apgar score, and you just circle it. It gives you a grade of pain, and then you treat or not treat accordingly. And so that's up for some information for you guys to look at. And it's well documented in the literature, and so it's an idea. I tried to look at streamlining drugs in the sense of, the issue of, we put MAG, by the way. We suggest MAG, for example, in wheezing. It's well known. I know it came up. I know that Wake County is doing it. So in the pediatric protocol, when you have options of epi or whatever, and if you have drugs on board, MAG is there, the dosing is there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Before you get to, you don't have an issue between EpiPen and EpiPen.
No. Actually, what I have here is three things. I have, if you're old school and you don't have an EpiPen, what the dosing is. If you have a junior EpiPen, what the age is. And then if you have an EpiPen, all three are in there. Absolutely. We actually only have EpiPens in the WakeMed ER. And I would encourage to make it very simple. If it's not a cost issue, then you all do that as well. There were, and then dosing, so all your anti-seizure meds, if you were worried about that, a standardized route. Dosing, try to make it very, very simple so that it's done that way. So that they don't keep having to look it up. They don't have to keep looking it up. It's right there. They don't have to go to the back and maybe go across and get to the wrong line. There were issues around, though, there were some key issues EMSC talked about. Altered mental status. Altered mental status is much different in pediatrics than it is in adults. And so my argument is, especially for diabetic patients where the literature shows that less volume is better for the issue of increased cerebral risk for cerebral edema, that I've written a altered mental status protocol for pediatrics, okay? Because it's not just, you can branch out your glucoses differently and your dosing. Meaning if your glucose is really over 250, you don't give a 20 per kilo bolus to those kids. You give a 10 per kilo. And so these, again, are things. The last thing two other things passionate. There's nothing about SIDS or an ALTI. That was not addressed in the last things. Again, the question is, the whole issue around SIDS and ALTI go along with child abuse issues, go along with behavioral issues. So if you could look in what was written into for ALTI, SIDS, and then the behavioral issues, since kids are different than adults in that respect, taking out certain things of drug management issues, for example, for your behavioral health when you think it's, unless it's truly a psychotic kid, there are drug dosing on your protocols right now, which probably would be contraindicated in children. So it's just an informative issue. I am so done,
Any questions or comments?
Thanks a lot.
Does that help?
That was a lot of work. Thanks.
Yeah, so. I know there's a lot more there, and really don't kill the messenger. I think what would really help for any of you, if Joe would post my direct email, because whatever they had bounced back, and if you are passionate, instead of just posting it so that I can maybe supply you literature, if you individually want some evidence behind something to buy into something, that would be great. I know we're going to be meeting with Tripp in the next 2 weeks to kind of relook and really try to hone in on these protocols, kind of reduce things, and yes. And so in that sense, it would be great for that resource. Thanks.
Thank you, Donna. Any comments, Daryl?
No. Thank you, guys. All right, on the phone, 5-star, if you want to go to EMD. If you have a question. All right.
Yes, I'm Seth Hawkins out of Burke County. I have no EMD expertise. of particular note. I'm standing here in front of you only because Dr. Winslow has a silver tongue, and I'm a sucker. But there are EMD specialists, I think, here or on the phone. I'm hoping, and Randall's here in the back. You want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, you guys come up here and sit.
Why don't you sit in the firing line so they can actually
bring your headset,
reach the tomatoes
up,
for you.
Make you feel comfortable.
So our subcommittee didn't get the memo that we were supposed to post every comment. We followed the "that's just stupid" principle. I mean, not seriously, but EMD is a little unique in that a lot of the comments, in fact, every comment except for one that we found, either had to do with contractual issues with specific vendors who did the protocols, like prior dispatch and APCO, or were cranky about their relationship with NCUMS and, you know, we wish they answered the phone in the third ring or something like that. So we were going to be very quick because we actually whittled it down to two recommendations that we filtered through all the comments that that seemed to actually deal with the protocols and the standards as written, which, in fact, were only three lines anyway. So I did think
I
got the best
of
them.
Responses to education.
Yeah, so I'm definitely getting to that. So the first, I think, was pretty innocuous. We recommended that emergency medical dispatch in some configuration be a part of the systems quality review committee. Any comments about that? I suspect it's probably happening already in most places. The other recommendation we had was that the word significant be put in front of the word change when changing protocols. And this was an attempt to try to just for wordsmithing changes or very small changes, take out some of the intricacy of making protocol changes. This, of course, was not seen entirely favorably by NCOMS because they wanted to define significance. So I think we have a little more work to do in really defining what the changes are that we would like to have locally driven versus what requires maybe an email confirmation from the state versus what would require a full application to change the protocol. Is that a fair? Do you two want to introduce yourselves? Because you're the pros here.
I'm Judy Caffarelli of the EMD with Raleigh Wake.
And Randy Wood, Forsyth County EMD Center.
Any comments here from the phone?
Most of the vendors don't allow you to make changes.
So these would be, local changes about how the system works. That's why our job is kind of skinny, because when you separate all the things that are already vendor-driven and you separate out the things which are just like policy with NCOMS, our protocol document is basically three lines long, and I think, you know, we were trying to see if there was a way to simplify changes that happened, but you're right. It's the reason most of the comments couldn't really be addressed by this community is they actually dealt with things that were proprietary documents from a vendor. But the document does say that that the state medical director has to approve any changes that you could somehow find out, you know, you could do through the vendor. So then 10 days ago, we were given a very large document from the Education Committee and told, hey, why don't you review all these comments as well? So the Education Tax Task Force had a lot of thoughts about how EMD might run differently. And I don't know if you want me to run through these quickly or they'll all be up on the website if people want to look at them separately.
You
got
10
more
minutes. Yeah.
Dude, 10 minutes, I can do this and we can, like, you know.
I heard EMD and the Education Committee was the item that kept the state folks, you know, kept the committee hot.
Well, good. We'll go through them.
At home to make sure I understood.
We'll go through them piece by piece then. That's okay with you guys. I think it's your exact language is up there, so I'm going to sit down.
And I might have mutilated it, so y'all be feeling correct anything I messed up.
Actually, you know what? I may let you guys speak to these since I think this is your specific language up there. But the first suggestion was to change credentialing to a two-year cycle.
Well, I'll go first, and Judy and I agree on most of these things, I think. And I think we both agree that this would create additional work if unnecessarily. The proprietary EMD program is recertified every 2 years and state every 4 years. So I just feel like we just create additional paperwork and work for everybody concerned.
Can I ask, the net effect, is this rule now on credential? So it's tied to changes of the rules.
Right.
It's a little,
to no benefit.
That's a totally different process and timeline from where we are today with the NCEP recommendations.
That's why we want to be clear.
Right.
These were not things that came up from our committee. These were given to us
absolutely
as the education task force. These are our comments about it.
EMD is definitely the least identified, hardest working group we have in the EMS system. So I'm happy to see that there was discussion on both sides.
Other comments? The other suggestion is consider allowing EMD centers the ability to locally recredential their personnel.
There's already a mechanism in place. I think you have to jump through some hoops to get there. We don't do it, but.
What we're only teaching this to them for Forsyth County, and our recredential our folks every 4 years whenever certification is done. So
I think
it's kind of a moot point. There is a mechanism there for it. So.
Just a comment on that. We're a little bit different. So I feel that the reason it falls under the local is the best teaching institution, our recredential. And I'm all for them having their own teaching institution, but when they have
third recommendation allowing MCMS to accept the same requirements for Con Ed as the current two vendors that are used in North Carolina.
I personally, and I think Judy agreed with me, we both agree with this request here. I think it's a duplication or, you know, I think that the proprietary EMT continuing ed should satisfy the state. It's fairly concise.
I agree.
And there's a suggestion that we not name specific vendors, and I think the only difficulty would be that if you have to have some standard, like, you know, I can't put up a shop and say I have an EMD product and I'd like to. So we need to have some sort of.
Yeah, well, that's in the rule already right now.
Right.
They have to use one of the vendors.
So we have to name those.
I think the challenge, I mean, these are things that are more rule and state level kinds of decisions. I think the challenge that I would encourage us to at least consider is certainly everyone's setting up the table have EMD centers, but, you know, we only have about two-thirds or approaching three-fourths of our centers, dispatch centers, having EMD. And, you know, I think that is one of the last frontiers in EMS, is how do we get 100% of our centers to do EMD for us? And I think there's a way that NSF can empower that or, you know, somehow encourage that through their documents, and that would be a very positive thing. I think these are more operational for EMD programs that exist. And so I think from a medical direction perspective, you know, NSF's role is more limited in these kinds of things. But I think the real need for the state is how do we get the other third of our centers out there to implement EMD, if any of them are run by law enforcement or our emergency management or entities that aren't necessarily, don't necessarily have EMS high on their radar.
And do you think that comes up as one of the items? This is really more lingering around that topic. Should you have that content adopted, you could discontinue the EMT credentialing classes, which would kind of be intuitive. So to work with the 911 board to identify funding opportunities.
Yeah, and like this says here, there is a bill that was passed by the House last year in regards to use of 911 funds. There is a list of eligible expenses. I'm not sure that would meet that. I don't think it would quite meet that list. But there is grant money out there available through the 911 board to implement the EMD service.
So certainly it's an innocuous recommendation to look for money as long as it's legal. To create a quality assurance performance improvement standard that follows a nationally recognized accreditation program. I think it was sort of seen as like,
I mean,
sure, if it didn't.
I mean, like, we're accredited, so I don't want to go through more steps that I already go through. I know not everybody's accredited, obviously. I just think the concern is the time, the effort, what is it called?
The sense that I got, so basically I'm here kind of in a secretarial role, which is sort of what I do more and more in the emergency department anyway, as we have like physician order entry and EMRs, and you know, basically I'm a glorified secretary, so I'm really good at this now. And the sense I got was just that there's a little bit of a burden of local accreditation, vendor accreditation, and then state level accreditation. So I think I'm sensitive to the idea that we don't want to kind of overburden people. So to make EMD data part of the EMS PIC by allowing the centers to enter data directly. I think that we collapsed. I think the reason why they're stunned is that we collapsed a couple. This is good editing because we've only got
took a lot of sense.
30 seconds left. But I think the idea was to take that sentiment along with a lot of other liaison kind of ideas to allow EMS PIC, NCOMS, and the EMDs locally to work more closely together in a number of ways. I just killed it.
Yeah, the biggest comment I kind of seemed to see on the survey was just, they thought EMD should be more involved with, or medical direction should be more involved with EMD. That's, in some counties where there's a pretty big gap there, and that's one of the things I noticed. Anyway.
You'll be delighted to hear I killed your.
I don't know. Killed what?
They're
good.
It's out of the
we're
slideshow.
Good.
But I
have a question that I've not found a good answer to yet, and I'm a little confused myself on how the educational committee's recommendation is going to merge with the NSEP recommendations. When and where are they going to merge, and who's going to have the final say-so?
Excellent question to turf to our OEMS crowd, because it's a Venn diagram. You've got NSEP making components. You've got rules in the making. You've got review of current guidelines. They're all going to collide sometime. Regina, when would you say that would be? Sure. The question is, when all this is all said and done, we got NSEP creating a policy piece for EMD. We've got the educational task force. We've got inevitably what will end up being rule revision potentially. What's the calendar on all that?
I have no idea. I don't have a timeline. I'm hoping it's the next year, but we're going to set the date. Everyone is going to see recommendations in place if we accept it.
Right.
I mean, it's a process. I really don't have to send advance to you.
So we're still middle of the road. We have
are, but we need to have an educational task force and support this and continue to work. We don't want not to.
So, at worst case scenario, the work's being done and it'll be concluded and reported, shared, whatever the draft is, discussed across the various councils and organizations, commissions, and then there'll be a public hearing. So there's plenty of opportunity to continue.
So to sum up what you find for our subcommittee, we have two filtered recommendations that EMDs be part of the quality medical review process, and that there'd be a streamlined way to make any changes, which probably there won't be any. And then there's a large amount of commentary on the Education Committee's recommendations just as feedback from us.
Excellent. Questions? Any questions on the phone? Raise your hand. 5-star. Hearing none.
Data collection. Data. We have anything for data collection?
We have just a short. You don't have any slides.
No, there really wasn't anything to put.
No. All right. Well, nothing. Well, let's talk about data then.
We like data.
There was a fair amount of discussion within the survey about data implementation, and hand-in-hand it goes with the QI process. We've had some informal discussions amongst the committee members, but really it's the work that's ahead that's going to be important. What I'd like to see us do is sit face-to-face with representatives from the PIC, from OEMS, from our stakeholder group and committee members, and work through where we are currently in the environment of data, nationally. Where NMSIS 3.0 is, what the impact is of making changes, data elements, if we through NSET's process, remove a data element, what's the effect on that downstream for a toolkit, et cetera. And we don't know that. The committee doesn't know that. So I propose across before the July meeting in Asheville, that we have that opportunity face-to-face, and we walk through some of the issues that have been identified in the survey. Commercial vendors certainly are lining up to address NMSA standards as a product for national distribution. I think we've got to consider what's the best fit to continue to do the business we do. And again, not knowing all behind as we peel that onion, what's there. Because I do think it was like already referenced earlier today, knowing numbers on procedures and what outcomes are and integrating data from dispatch to discharge is really our goal at an aggregate level. That's my read on this. We still got to meet, look at what's out there. Greg and the PIC folks have provided us background information across NMSIS 3. We just need to dig down and see what, as this recommendation comes forward, the impact of selecting either a data standard or an associated amalgam, what that means.
The only other piece I'd add, my understanding is the PIC is looking only for NMSIS 3.0 data when 3.0 is
available,
not for more.
Right.
And I think it's and that's where our medics position was, but everybody else needs to speak in that too. That would be our aim.
Yeah, I mean there are options of, you know, creating supplemental data elements that are beyond them. Many states do that. We are one of the few that don't. Version 3 of NMSIS, one of the big changes with version 3 is that in the past, when version 2 came out, there was only about 60 or 70 elements that were recommended to be included in a national database. And so each state was asked to start with those and then branch that out to what you needed at a state and local level. With version 3, they now are defining state-recommended elements, which have to do with performance measures. And so the information that I've given to Joseph, you know, has now a revised national list, but now there's also a state list, which 160 or so elements, I think. And then each state's asked to look at that as their minimum and then branch out from that, you know, in addition as needed. And our data set currently is a little over 200 elements. So the state recommended elements for version 3 are much closer to what we do. A lot of states are a lot different.
I appreciate Joe Frazier's invitation to host that meeting.
Any
other comments on data? Five star if you're on the line. Question about data? Our next grouping is PI, and we'll have to see who's out there on the phone. I don't know. We'll find out. I'm thinking not. Or he's thinking, can I stand up again?
Jose Caballos is the chair of the subcommittee. He was actually not feeling well today, so we weren't sure if he was going to make it or not. A lot of what they're waiting for right now, correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, is the NHTSA 3.0 to come out. Things based on that somewhat, but I know they come up with some initial things to look at.
Am I correct? Yeah, he had provided basically, you know, currently there's a grid of reports and standards recommended to follow. Do you have that in your slides?
I didn't. The Excel document?
Yeah.
I don't have the Excel document.
So there'll be a document out on our website that basically is a first cut of must-do, must-have reporting. Today, the current document is felt to be excessive. And it's not directed. There's stuff that's only available through local collection and not off of toolkits or otherwise. So, you know, we want to do the right thing. We want people to measure common elements. And at this point, I think you just need to see the document to react to it to see if we're heading down the right direction across the clinical bundles that make a difference to evaluate system performance. And then I think the other thing that comes to mind is other groups who have QI issues to report, especially care, coming to mind first, is how are we adjusting those reporting guidelines for other providers, service providers?
There's a few comments from the survey that they wanted maybe PI to be a little more clinical based and not, I know it has to be mainly data driven, but maybe a little bit more clinical. Parameters to measure. I'm not sure exactly how you do that, and I would appreciate some input from the group and the people throughout the state on maybe the best way to do that, because, you know, obviously sometimes, you know, the data can mean one thing going in but mean something else coming out, and you're not exactly sure what the data means sometimes, so if there's some way to make it more clinical, perhaps, I'm not sure how you do that, but that was some of the comments. The new list they're looking at in four sections, clinical, conditions, clinical procedures, high-risk clinical situations, and operational performance metrics. Some of the clinical conditions they wanted to come down on, as you can see here, they're definitely your more high-risk areas. I don't know if you have any comments about that. Somebody beat? And obviously some of your more possibly high-risk procedures, not necessarily IV access. Tracheal? Is that a word?
At 3 o'clock in the morning, maybe it works.
That's the French word.
Yeah. Is that with the worm?
Some of the procedures they're coming down on. And obviously the high-risk clinical situations. And here, and then you have the performance metrics they were looking at. I think most of these are fairly obvious.
Just in sort of easily before to kind of help get communities to report things that matter. Can we include response times to see both of the first responder as well as the transport resource in an effort to help kind of force communities to compile that data in a way that's meaningful? Because I think from a clinical outcome perspective,
yeah,
we all could argue that the response time to the first responder is most important.
I agree.
And we report response time to the ambulance, which is easier.
I think that's definitely something I've asked about my own county sometimes, and that's, as you probably know, one of the more difficult things to get many times.
It is. If we got an opportunity here to say something.
Yeah. I agree that it is the most, probably the most important thing, especially things like cardiac arrest and your other high-risk clinical situations.
The definition of response time, too, between EMS providers and first responders may be different, too.
The time to the bedside or the patient side or
wheels rolling or
right.
Checking route or receive. So
there's some definitions. They might. I haven't reviewed those definitions recently, but we definitely want to make sure we have those specifically addressed. obviously, we're going to put this on the website. We'd like y'all's input on whether these are inclusive enough, not inclusive enough. We'll also, Jose worked on an Excel spreadsheet, which is more of the PI metric. It was completely inclusive. We'll put that up on the website, too, for y'all's, so y'all can give your input. And he was also asking whether you want more mandatory, recommended, optional type list for the PI.
Optional.
I heard optional.
Well, yeah, optional.
Optional second time. Original third time. And Jose would like any input y'all have. Any other comments on that?
Right
here. Oh, he brought his own. So. Jeff was a little hesitant to use my slides for probably a good reason. So he's bringing his own. Y'all get him a little bit. Anybody use any other reference?
You
want to
take five?
You take five.
Or four.
Here, absolutely. allowed for within protocols and within what's approved by the medical board. So the full list of medications approved by the medical board is linked off of the OMS webpage, the HHS webpage. And so if you have interest in that or you have interest in what medications you can and can't use, that's where you should go. So all of this is to say that the vast majority of comments that I personally have gotten and the vast majority of survey comments that the subcommittee has looked at were, you know, from field personnel or from training officers or from whoever saying, well, I want to use fentanyl. Why can't I use fentanyl? That's not a question for us, per se. That's a system-level question. That fentanyl or whatever it is that you want to use very likely is a approved medication. And so the issues arise when either a medication is unapproved by the medical board or when sort of the issues regarding what's required when the state comes to visit or what's required by your local medical director in terms of a specific protocol. So the charge to each of the subcommittees, as you all know, is, you know, essentially as the survey was set up, you know, do we need to add something? Do we need to remove something? Do we need to change something? In terms of removing, we do not recommend that we remove any medications that are approved by the North Carolina Medical Board. To give some perspective, there's about 50 or so, 55 meds that are listed on that in that drug list document. There are also 50 or 55 specific meds, not the same meds, in the NCMB document, but then there's like 20 to 25 classes of medications. And clearly, somebody, probably with the last name of Mears, was thinking when he went to the board to ask for classes, because when you get the class of paralytics approved, well, all of a sudden you don't have to go asking when you want to use VEC versus ROC versus whatever. So I think that that's an important sort of thing to put out front for you guys, because that's where a lot of the confusion, a lot of the questions comes from. So if you can take that back to your systems and sort of keep that in mind as we talk about very specific recommendations, I think that that'll be very helpful to clarify the process. So that being said, there's about seven or so meds that were suggested throughout the survey and comment process that were suggested as possible additions that are not currently on the NCMB list. So those are propofol, ketamine, phenylephrine, octreotide, Presidex, glycopyrrolate, and droperidol. NAC, I think, also came up in verbal commentary. I'm not sure whether it was on the survey or not, but at any rate, I've read that thing so many times, I don't remember anymore.
Can you clarify that droperidol is removed by whom?
No, they're asking for it.
Okay, but
it's not approved. These are current medications that are not approved by the North Carolina Medical Board that somebody in that survey asked for.
Class of antipsychotics, that was...
Yeah, your paraphernalia is approved.
Is it approved?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think my recollection is we had this debate the last go-round about how much weight to give black box warning.
That may be an oversight of mine. I don't recall... Seeing.
I can't remember if it's
anti-psychotic agents.
Is it a fee?
I'll
look into that. I'm pretty sure it's true.
Okay.
I've been telling people it is.
All right, well, I appreciate the expertise in the room. I've been doing this not as long as those guys. At any rate, moving on from the droperidol. So we would not recommend, droperidol, the droperidol discussion notwithstanding, are people using droperidol?
The only reason we're not is because we thought we could.
Yeah, it's considered a phenobiotine preparation. So
okay. I was trying to.
But yeah, the black box stuff you have to weigh yourself, but it's medical board allowed.
So, okay. All right. So, good point. And everybody's aware of the black box warning regarding QT prolongation, blah, 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 blah. Okay. So we'll set that aside for a moment. But based on our conversations with Dr. Mears and others, we would not think that it would be politically palatable or feasible or even reasonable to go to the medical board and ask for ketamine, Presidex, propofol, not to mention that there are clearly alternatives in the pre-hospital setting. Now, several, most of the comments regarding the meds that are unapproved are from the specialty care transport group, and that's based on verbal conversation as well as just sort of my interpretation of who's filling out the survey. So, for example, octreotide, NAC, phenylephrine is pretty much the only vasopressor in common usage that's not already approved. And then maybe glycopyrrolate, I assume, for the indication of airway management. But I don't know that these are medications that the pre-hospital personnel, you know, the medic on the street who's taking somebody from the field to the hospital are going to have a huge use for. I see the difference in specialty care transport. So one issue for this group, one issue for this group is to decide, you know, is this a battle that we need to fight across the board for field EMS personnel, the medics in my county and your county, or can this be an issue that we take up with the between the state medical director and the North Carolina Medical Board? So the question arises, so how do medications get approved? And essentially, the state medical director has a conversation with the state medical board and provides supporting evidence behind why we need to be giving, you know, Mucomist or Tylenol overdose in the field. I mean, I have no use for that in Orange County, but, you know, a specialty care transport service with a long time and a known Tylenol level, I mean, maybe they have the use for that. So the process is for the state medical director to have a conversation with the North Carolina Medical Board regarding medications that are currently not approved by the board, but we would like them to be approved by the board for subsequent inclusion in the protocols. Does that make sense? So if somebody or a particular group, especially care transport, obviously, has a need for a med, wants to make a case for that med, the correct avenue is via the state medical director to the medical board. Does that make sense? Otherwise, I don't know, and we can continue to talk about this over the months, I don't know that there's a huge need to and I, frankly, Dr. Mears probably have a better perspective than I, but I don't know that there's a huge need to pick a particular fight over a med that might not otherwise be in wide usage. The rest of the main issue, I feel like, having done this for several months now, is sort of having all of you be on the same page about what is the purpose of the drug list in the back of the document, how can we make sure there's not errors in it, how can we make sure that the protocols are reflecting, the drug list is reflected in the protocols that you use. So, that's the issues regarding the medical board. So, the comments and suggestions regarding the drug list that I've just spoken about reflect basically local practice. So variations in a specific narcotic, variations in a specific steroid, variations in a specific H2 blocker. So preliminarily, we would sort of stick with the plan, for lack of a better term. If a medication shows up in the protocols of a particular county or a particular agency, then clearly it should show up in the drug list. I think we've had long discussions about including the drug dosages in the specific protocols. If we want to continue the current format and also have a drug list at the back of the document simply as a catalog or a reference, absolutely we can do that. The catch, as we've discussed earlier today a couple of times, is that that drug list, there may be 100 different drug lists. You know, the vast majority on those drug lists are going to be the same, but if we truly want to allow systems to say, for example, choose what narcotic they use and not just say that, you know, every system has to use fentanyl or whatever, then clearly there's going to be differences in the drug list. And therefore, by definition, that makes it difficult to create a statewide drug list. I think that it's sort of a little bit redundant and probably next to impossible to create a drug list per se or a catalog per se of all the North Carolina Medical Board approved medications. Medications come and go, and new medications are added to classes you know, that's a reference that probably would not be useful to field personnel. So I think that any drug list that reflects what's in the protocols is probably going to be based on those protocols and therefore different across systems. Brent, to get to your issue regarding droperidol, one way to look at this is that individual systems that use individual drugs for individual protocols probably should have their own drug list. I know that that causes nausea for me and for a lot of other people who are saying, oh, great, now I've got to not only introduce my medics to this is the state list and then this is our list. That certainly has come up as a concern of folks before, but frankly, it's probably the most accurate way to have your personnel understand what's in their toolbox that they're using on a day-to-day basis.
Let me clarify. You said the medic has to have the state drug list and the local drug list?
No, I think the challenge in creating a statewide document is realizing that either there just won't be a statewide drug list, which is fine by me, let's work for me, or there clearly are going to be two lists. I mean, we can have what we have now. We can create and/or modify and/or update a statewide drug list that includes, you know, example medications. For medications that exist in the statewide protocols. I mean, we can have exactly what we have now, but clearly I think that medics in most systems are going to want to know, when it says Dilaudid or fentanyl or morphine, well, which one is it that we use? And so therefore, there should be a more specific system-wide drug list. So I think we can do two different things. We can do no statewide drug list, and then you can have, you know, baseline state protocols and have a system-specific drug list, or you can have what we have now, which is a generic, you know, drug list that's going to have the vast majority of medications that are used, but then clearly there's going to be some differences based on a system.
But don't you think
system?
Having a state protocol list, then you can adapt and cut and paste and put into your own system, allows consistency and kind of at least on a PDAC perspective, you not just go to the protocol and remind yourself that
No, I think, yeah, don't misunderstand me.
Talking on the peace perspective, that then, obviously, every group, if they choose only one of those drugs, and that's all they want in their protocol, then they'll remove those drugs.
Right, no, don't misunderstand me. I agree with that 100%. Frankly, that's how I would lean, is to have what we have now. But what I hope to implore, again, to all of you, is that you take back to your systems the fact that, by definition, that means there will be differences between what your system uses and what's on the state drug list. There may be things that you use that are not on the state drug list. There may be things that that are on the state drug list that are not used in your system. And that's a clear source of confusion.
Huh? Can you have that first item? There are things that you will use that are not on the state drug list?
Sure. They're going to be approved by the medical board. They're prednisolone. Prednisolone. Or
state
list. Right. Well, I think that's the first level.
OEMS state list and medical board.
But all this is reference, right? I mean, everything you've talked about is back of the book.
It will be once the drug dosing is in the flow sheet protocol.
Correct.
At the moment, it is available to patient care. Yes.
Correct.
Because we don't have the...
Correct. That's a very good point. As it is now, it is the reference for the appropriate dose. And I think that
if we modify this protocol, has that in it, kind of what I see is this thing in the back is everything. And if we want to add Vasotec in there, droperidol, and anything that's on the list, have an exhaustive drug list in the back, and that's coming throughout all systems, I don't have any issue with that. What's in the protocol is what you use. So that's then a reference document, and if there's a drug that's not in your protocols anywhere, that's what we've got to try to deal with. Do you gray it out? Do you have the option to somehow delineate on your own set, this drug's not in our box, for whatever reason.
Sure.
And then how does that apply to you, which is beginning to a state inspection?
Sure. No, I hear what you're saying. And again, that's the way I lean personally to do it. We should be clear, though, that we either need to clarify in state rules or we need to clarify in this document the fact that there are medications that are allowed for use by the North Carolina Medical Board that are not in protocol.
Yeah, I think there's a third category of drugs that we in frontier and rural agencies we're faced with where they're transport drugs. We never carry them on a truck, but like if I'm running a COVID-STEMI and I've started thrombolytics and I want to get that patient out, it's going to take me longer to get a specialty care unit than to send my own guys. So suddenly they're monitoring a thrombolytic risk if we do it quickly like we want it. So I've had the kind of ludicrous scenario where the medic's supposed to wait until the drip is done, put the patient in the truck, because they're not allowed to monitor a thrombolytic drip. You know, so there's going to be some drugs that will never be on the truck, but you may want to actually have your medic able to monitor, if not administer.
And that was one question I had about the specialty care, like, if you want to get a map, whatever. And this is, I don't know Google well, but if a physician at the referring or receiving facility puts that on order, is there any leeway, even though it's
a limit to the use of charcoal or frankly just remove it from the protocol is that there's not a whole lot of evidence there that that's helpful. But again, that's an approved North Carolina Board medication, so if we take it out of the protocol and it's not on the drug list, you know, that's sort of the issue that we deal with when we remove medication, which is fine. Cimetidine is sort of, so again, the class, H2 blockers, as a class, the entire class, is approved by the North Carolina Medical Board. The one that happens to show up in the allergic reaction protocol is cimetidine. Our personal preference would be to not use cimetidine and to encourage the use of newer H2 blockers solely for the drug-drug interaction reason. Again, just a recommendation, a drug-specific recommendation. Lasix, so just take Lasix out, would be our recommendation. You know, nobody's going to go to the medical board and have it, you know, get kicked off the list because it might be the greatest thing since sliced bread next year for some other reason. But clearly, probably not a huge role for Lasix in the pre-hospital arena in terms of pulmonary edema, which is the only place that it currently is in the protocol.
That's for adults who have general heart disease.
We wouldn't have that on the protocol, probably. That'd be more of a direct medical order, more than likely.
That would be my comment. Yeah, that would be my comment. Mag sulfate, we could add an indication for mag sulfate for wheezing and respiratory distress. That was a comment suggestion. Mag sulfate is already in the protocol in other places, namely obstetrics, but we could add the indication for wheezing. Not a whole lot of downside for that. The class, quote, steroid preparations is approved by the North Carolina Medical Board, so I think that probably a member of that class that should be specifically mentioned is prednisolone as the most commonly given steroid preparation to a kid with asthma. It's allowed, but it's not in the drug list. And then procainamide. We can probably debate procainamide for a really long time, and we won't. But currently, protocol 45 says verbatim, consider procainamide. So if we're going to put it in there, then we probably need to add peds dosing to that. If we don't want it in there at all, then we just take it out. But we need to reconcile that somehow. And those are the specific recommendations that we came up with preliminarily. I don't think I have any more time, but I would ask the group to consider, you know, going forward, if we are going to have a statewide list of medications, then people must communicate and understand that that's not necessarily going to be the exact same list that your system uses. Thank you.
Good job. Any questions from the phone? Five star, we'll open it up for you. I'm going to try to get you out of here near time.
Jeff? It was kind of pointed out to me at the break that there's not only the drug list in the back of part of the book, the standard stream of medication skills. Are you going to be looking at that list as well, the PSO checklist?
So that's the Skills and Meds Subcommittee, which presented this morning.
Yeah.
Their niche in all of this, as we've best fleshed it out, is determining which level gives which med or treatment or skill or whatever.
You know, we had a little conversation about LASIK that is not in the protocol. There's two or three more, especially special care transport programs that need to be addressed. But I know where to find you after.
We had Lasix and said we're going to take it out of protocol, but then said also the drug list. Does that mean it's not available or just going to be removed from protocol?
So, I think anybody is suggesting that we go to the medical board and we ask not to be able to use a given medication. The drug list is merely a list, just a simple catalog of the drugs that exist in the protocol. So in all, how many ever, 70, whatever protocol. So the only place that Lasix is currently mentioned in the protocols is in the pulmonary edema protocol. And I think there are those of us who would argue that Lasix for pulmonary edema in the pre-hospital setting is probably not helpful.
But for the rules, for changing protocols, you're allowed to add medications to the protocols. Correct, Greg?
That would be one of the ways.
So one way that it would look is that if on a state basis we were to agree, or the protocols committee were to agree, that that Lasix was not indicated for pulmonary edema in the pre-hospital setting, and it were therefore to be removed from the protocol, it would not show up in the state list. Your system, should your medical director decide, or anyone's medical director decide, that they want Lasix or they want this or that for a particular protocol that they're modifying and that they're getting state approval for, that med would obviously then be in your drug list. And I think it's sort of on the local medical director to maintain an accurate drug list and accurate dosages for medications that their system uses that may not be included in the statewide drug list.
Got a question on
this? I have a counter question.
Hi, this is Juan.
Go ahead, Juan.
Hi again, it's Juan. I know the North Carolina Medical Board, for example, has approved labetalol, and in fact, I think they've approved beta blockers as a whole for use in the pre-hospital setting. I know in our own system, our drug list has approval for labetalol, but that's only specific for my county. Obviously, one of my requests, obviously, is to add it not only to the drug list for everyone at the state level, but also specifically to add it in the hypertensive protocol. So it's sort of a double request, both labetalol for the drug list statewide as well as for the hypertension protocol.
With all due respect, there is no evidence between hypertension and pre-hospital drugs. UHA guidelines clearly state that. So I think that's a community practice standard that is perfectly appropriate for certain communities, but I'm not going to endorse that. And so I would respectfully disagree with any delay law to say that.
So, sorry, I didn't hear the comments.
Brent disagrees with you,
Juan. I'm sorry, who disagrees with me? Brent Myers. Would you agree, though, that nitroglycerin for treatment of a hypertension in the setting of a stroke is inappropriate?
All right, I'm out of here.
No, we don't have time to debate it here. I think that's an offline thing, but I don't think we should add labetalol just at 2 minutes past three. We need longer time to talk about that.
Fair enough.
Some of them are on the
feet. So I'm hearing Jeff has more work to do.
Well, so I have to, I just have
I would challenge any of us to debate, you know, okay, so what exactly is included in the class of, you know, steroid agents? Are we really going to list every agent as a steroid? Oh, absolutely we should list the class. Sure, if we could go all the way, we could list the class. We can certainly list the class. But the second point I would make, though, is that any listing that's that broad is going to be problems. Any listing that's that broad and it's not protocol-based, you're going to run across big problems in terms of dosing, indication, a specific agent within a class that may be a better choice for a particular indication. I have no problem mirroring the list, but if we're trying to make a specific document, as Dr. Sutherland suggested, it's truly a reference, we're going to end up with a lack of specificity that I don't think solves the problem.
And are there that many additional meds that need to be put outside the cell and then need to be are there so many drugs that are on the board list that we don't have already in our protocol? Consider standard care what we stock and what is the cheapest and best or whatever.
There's probably a few. Our main issue is the 20 or 25 or so classes of medication. And for sanity to list every medicine in a class.
We might want to discuss, I'm not sure we have time.
Sure.
Definitely brings up an important point, though. And we'll probably discuss it further. Maybe y'all can discuss it in the subcommittee, maybe get some more map.
Bring us a solution.
I think it does have a point, but I'm not sure where the correct way to go is either.
And just to clarify, I think you can classify with class that you don't actually need to list 400 steroid preparations. But the medical board list here has got individual medications and it's got groups, non-steroidal, sterilized agents. There's no reason why we can't list them that way.
All right.
All right. Changing gears.
Jeff Ferguson from East Care, Pitt County EMS. I'm the chair of the EMS policies subcommittee. We have basically at the last meeting decided that we were going to kind of pare this down and make it very easy. So I promise this will be the shortest of all the subcommittee presentations today. Basically, of the 20 policies that are present on the Office of EMS website today, we will review them, edit them, and remain. They will remain available for agency use in the past. The agencies, however, this will be new. They will have the option of using the policies as they're published, or they can edit their own as long as there is a policy covering each topic that the original 20, unless we decide to delete some. There have been a few comments that that are not that. Some of them are no longer needed because of protocols and other procedure lists. There are a few suggestions for new policies. We're going to kind of get into that between now and July. And I guess this is kind of nearing the end of the comment period for any existing policies or any potential policies. So if anybody has any ideas for new policies or strong feelings that some of the 20 that are there now need to go away, now is the time. There were about 6 pages of comments from the survey. If you take out all the comments that were actually geared more towards protocols and procedures, people obviously don't know the difference between those 3 P words. But if you take those out, it really cuts the list of comments down by about half. And then after that, there's as many for a procedure as there are against. So not a lot of great feedback from the survey, unfortunately. So as it stands right now, there won't be a huge change in the list. Any feedback?
That's it.
Hurrah.
All right.
Well done.
Juan, got any comments?
Thank you, Joe.
Excellent. Oh, yes. Go ahead. Speak.
I don't know if anybody had commented, and this goes back to just personal preference. I noticed on the seizure protocol, number 31, there was no mention made of in regards to pregnancy. and obviously eclampsia. And I think, I don't know how best to put it in there, but it needs to be in there somewhere.
I think that's covered in OB emergencies protocol with many of the references.
It is, in fact, but unfortunately, if the patient initially presents with a seizure, and they're obviously there's a comment in seizure under history of pregnancy, but there's no comment in there in terms of going to the OB if they're pregnant as a first line. So theoretically, they would go down, you know, based on this. If a pregnant lady is having a seizure, they would go ahead and do this. I don't think the OB. Seizure-like activity. I think there should be a reference somewhere either in the pearls or somewhere in the differential. There it is. I'm sorry. I'm wrong. It's got it in there. Forget it. Forget
right.
it. Cancel that.
Thanks.
It's in there.
It's good to be the king.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much it, unless anyone has any other comments, concerns, doubts, anything like that. Once again, thanks everybody for coming. Chief Gaudette, really appreciate you coming and giving you all the input. I appreciate the awesome EMS as hell. Did y'all have any more comments? Thank you. So our next meeting is July 13th in Asheville. I'm trying to time with, like Chief Cadet said, the Administrators Conference. And thanks a lot. Sorry.
I know Brent Myers was going to be in my portion. None of us know which way to hold the golf course.
Right, exactly right.
Thank you, guys.